This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Can our evolutionary design stop humans from solving climate change? A new study finds environmental competition and conflict between sub-global groups work against global solutions. No wonder climate talks fail as energy giants and consumerism compete to expand. Dr. Timothy Waring models the evolution of sustainable behaviors, institutions, and socio-ecological systems. At the School of Economics and Mitchell Center, University of Maine, Tim Waring is Associate Professor of Applied Cultural Evolution. He developed models, co-founded international working groups, and publishes heavily. From Maine, Tim Waring, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with this. French philosopher Paul Virilio warned humans are not threatened by our failure, but by our success. Does that fit in with your work?
I think that's a really good summary. That is a very concise summary of the research that I've recently done. What we find is, as we're trying to understand the long-term process of humans in the environment, is that we've been very much characterized by just our smashing success. And I think that has, in a lot of ways, got us into the problems we're facing with environmental management today.
And every year, thousands of experts and political leaders fly to a meeting to solve climate change. But often nothing substantive happens and greenhouse emissions continue to increase. Can your work help explain why?
Yes, I think it can. This is the question that I've been wrestling with for some time and trying to understand how and why we might be able to come together to solve global challenges, collective action problems like climate change, should be a primary focus for nations, international groups, for the whole planet and our whole species. And yet you see that it's hard to achieve. And so our work is trying to explore why that is, what we can expect based on what we know about human evolution, and then how we can use that to try to make progress in a new way on these challenges.
Tim, when you say evolution could work against solving global problems, are you talking about the slow million-year development of genes and species or shorter-term social and cultural evolution?
I study human cultural evolution primarily, and that's mostly what we're concerned about. Now, human culture is based on genetic traits that all humans have, that we have developed over, as you say, millions of years. And those traits allow us to be the super social species that we are, where we're born and have a very long developmental period where we learn language and we learn practices and habits and we learn to prefer different types of food. We acquire social identities. We acquire religious identities, perhaps. And that, all of that is culture. And the interesting thing about all of that is the culture that we inherit. Now, we inherit most of it, right, from our family and our friends and our networks and communities, is not something that we just create. Instead, it has been passed down and modified for many generations. And so this is the primary focus of the research that I want to share with you today.
Well, we're going to need global agreements, and they won't be easy. To reach net zero equitably, heavy consumers and fossil burners may have to give some things up. It's hard to imagine Americans or Chinese or international gangs or corporations getting together and sacrifice. Is the breakdown centered on nationalism, on race, religion, or what do you find?
What we look at here, I think I should talk about the study in two parts. We wanted to ask two questions in this study. We wanted to ask, how did this period where humans are threatening some of the basic biological processes of the planet, how did the Anthropocene evolve in the first place? And the second question is, what can we do using that information to help the Anthropocene be a more sustainable option for humans? You know, the French philosopher is correct in that we've been so successful that our success may be our greatest sort of problem. I think that's right on the money. And your point here and your question about whether the lack of agreement between nations or other groups is fundamentally because of politics or nationalism or money is a good one. It's actually not something that we look at directly, but the point that we see when we look at, and we can extend back, indeed, a very long time in human history and prehistory in order to understand how human groups have changed over time. Our primary sort of data for this was to look at what has been understood about the size of human groups, the types of materials and energy that they use, how many groups there are, how large they are, how complex they are, and all of these things, as we know, are largely organized by human culture. So when we form a society, we have rules and roles, and they might help divide our labor into different specialized areas so that we can effectively process matter and energy from the environment and use it to support a growing population. Now, the success is that we have been getting larger groups. Those groups have become then more capable because they have more minds. Because they have more minds, they figure out, literally more brains helps those groups figure out new ways to use environmental resources at greater intensities and at greater scales. This then leads to the growing of more groups, the proliferation of those groups, and that feeds back again. So then we have, for the vast majority of human evolution, even prehistorical evolution, in fact, most of it, we are characterized by an evolutionary ratchet in which the size and complexity of human cultural groups gets larger and larger. And that is linked with our use of the environment. So our use of the environment has gotten more intensive and at a larger and larger scale for literally tens of thousands of years, if not quite a lot longer. So that's the success at the root of our problem here. We sort of conclude that the Anthropocene is the result of human evolution. Long, deep-standing feedback processes in human evolution, which have allowed us to conquer environment after environment after environment as we spread across the planet. So that feedback process has been dramatically successful for our species. That's a wonderful thing as far as that goes. The problem that we wanted to look at is to understand how the environment has shaped us. This feedback process is only possible in an environment where there are more resources to consume and there's more space to grow into. And now that, you know, our species has largely filled up the planet, we're no longer in that same environmental condition. So the challenge that we're faced with is that the lack of cooperation that we might see here today over climate change, but that lack of cooperation might be an important signal that the challenges of working together on a limited planet, on a shared planet with limited resources, is different than the challenge of expanding and consuming more resources to compete with your rivals. Now, it might seem from our history that we have been adapted, especially culturally, our societies, our institutions, our technology, to be really effective at growing and consuming more resources in order to compete with rivals. And so that's the fundamental challenge that I think we're looking at in the Anthropocene.
Well, you've just discussed how adding more human minds is like adding more computing power or servers to a network. Now we're going to toss in artificial intelligence. Will that break the models?
I do some work on long-term human evolution, and I think artificial intelligence actually should be understood as simply a part of what humans create. Right? Artificial intelligence is a technology, and technology is a cultural product. Now, artificial intelligence is an impressive creation. I think people are correct to worry about its impact on societies and on the economy and even its environmental impact on the as a result of its energy consumption. But at the same time, it doesn't actually change my understanding of long-term human evolution. It just is an accelerator. However, like I've been saying, human evolution has been characterized by a positive feedback system between effective and highly adaptive cultural groups and the strength and power of those groups and their proliferation. So I think in some ways, the advent of modern artificial intelligence systems, large language models, and the like, is just another step which follows a general pattern. Now, the question that we wanted to ask is, has this acceleration put us in a dangerous spot? It seems like this acceleration has put us in a dangerous spot with regards to how humans are going to interact with global environmental challenges. So in order to do that, we wanted to explore the evolution of the human niche over time. There's a lot of work to be done here, but we just compiled a simple list of the ways in which humans have interacted with the environment as their groups have gotten larger and larger and more powerful over time. And in short, we have certain cultural traits that are useful for extracting resources and energy from the environment, and we have other traits that we use to manage that extraction, right? So we, on the one hand, use water to water our crops, to bathe and to wash and to cook and for industrial processes. On the other hand, we also have systems that are about the regulation of water use. We have irrigation systems that deliver water to the right place at the right time, but not too much, right? We have legal and technical systems that are designed to allow us to share the water, for example, in the Colorado River, among a very large number of people and across states, so that it's not overused. Of course, that's becoming a challenge now, is that those water sources don't get refilled as often as we were used to. But the point is, we have two different types of cultural technology that we have evolved. One is extraction technology, the extraction traits, and the other one is management traits. Now, what do we learn about these? An argument that we make in the paper is that extraction comes before management. And this you'll see in environmental case after environmental case. When do we enact fishing regulations? Before the fish have become scarce or after? Well, it's after. First we start fishing, and then we fish more. And finally we fish so much that fish populations start to decline. Then we get worried, and we enact fishing regulations. When do we enact forestry protections? When do we enact rules to stop pollution? When do we create rules about trash and littering and recycling? When do we create a system to find an alternative to ozone-depleting chemicals? All of these management actions and traits and technologies come after we have created a problem with an environmental resource or capacity in the first place. Of course, this is natural, right? We don't know about them, or simply there is no problem. But this is an important consideration, because if we are going to manage something at the scale of the global biosphere, we will need to solve some of these problems in a way before they become too strong. That's where it starts to become a larger problem. I think everyone appreciates that climate change, for example, is a global scale threat on a level that our species hasn't seen before. It really truly is. The science is unequivocal on the challenges we face with climate change. And I think those people who are looking at climate change, the challenge of adapting to climate change, and even more importantly, the challenge of mitigating our climate impacts and reversing our climate impacts, who are looking at that seriously, see it as the largest effort humans have ever undertaken. And it will be that for sure. However, there is a sort of belief, I think, among some in the policy realm that, well, we'll be able to solve this. We'll, you know, eventually come up with some solutions. Perhaps it's good to be optimistic. However, given what we understand about how human cultural evolution has been dominated by this group-level process for many tens of thousands of years, there's a very important additional challenge that we face. And that additional challenge is that we evolve most effectively as groups. We evolve cultural solutions to our problems in groups. And we don't really have an effective global level group. More importantly, We don't have a population of global groups. Now, why is that important? Population is important because adaptive traits emerge in a population. If one company comes up with a good way of organizing their human resources, that idea might spread to other companies, and that becomes an adaptation. And all of the companies in that industry are now doing this process, and it's more effective. That's an adaptation, and it happens in a population context. Same is true with nations and the emergence and spread of environmental protection agencies. We now have many different environmental protection agencies and laws and systems, and those are adaptations to conserve our environment and our environmental resources. Now, the important point here is that if we're hoping to create systems that protect the global biosphere, those will probably be the most complex environmental protection systems ever, because the biosphere is far more complex than simple environmental resources like water, for example. So we will need global-level technical, social, and legal systems for managing a complex biosphere at the scale of a planet. We've never done anything like this before. The question is, how do you arrive at that system that can successfully manage a global biosphere? That's the question, because that's clearly the thing that we need to enact in order to be able to simply keep our grip on the planet, in order to continue to survive. So we ask this question, when would these global systems of biosphere protection and management evolve? Unfortunately, our conclusion is that we're not in a situation where they are likely to evolve. Why is that? The reason is the size and scale of these global planetary protection traits and systems is at the scale of the planet. However, the population of human groups that we currently have, the population, as you say, Alex, of subglobal groups, which means they accumulate and transmit and compete with each other, and what they accumulate in that process is they evolve group-level cultural adaptations at the level of those groups. So for the United States, currently, to adopt a carbon tax, how do they look at it? Oftentimes, policymakers will look at it as a short-term cost, and it is a short-term cost. It's a short-term political and economic cost for those policymakers and decision-makers. And that's the problem. They're not wrong. Of course, it's a long-term cost for all of us not to adopt strong policy and adopt these systems. However, the point is, it's not just selfishness that's getting in our way. It's even the structure of our human cultural population, where we have a planet full of nations and a planet full of corporations that are learning from and competing with each other, rather than a galaxy full of planets that are learning from and competing with each other. In the latter case, we might see that some planets manage to protect their environment effectively, maintain and regulate their climate and their ocean and their biosphere, all of their biodiversity. On the other hand, or in our current system, without other planets to learn from, we as small sub-global groups, corporations and nations, learn from and compete with other corporations and nations. And none of them is able to decide to manage the biosphere, and yet the task is fundamentally at a scale above all of them. So this is the challenge, and this is what we call the population structure problem of the Anthropocene.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Our guest is Dr. Tim Waring, an expert in applied cultural evolution at the University of Maine. Your work reminds me of Paul Ehrlich and Bill Reese, perhaps taking next logical steps of study from their concerns. You developed a tool called Cultural Multi-Level Selection Framework for Sustainability Analysis. I hesitate to ask, but could you explain that to the layperson? What does it do?
A wonderful question. Yeah, the Cultural Multi-Level Selection Framework is a way to understand when humans solve collective problems and when we don't. Nobel Prize winner Eleanor Ostrom is famous for her findings about a set of institutions that help people in almost any context, but especially small-scale groups of people manage local natural resources. We see now that the same patterns and the same institutions are useful in many cases, almost no matter where the human group is and what resources they are using. However, those institutions are largely considered to be part of the solution to sustainability. You can look up Ostrom's 8 principles. Now, the question, though, is not just if those are a solution. I think in many cases they really are. If we can enact careful ways to regulate ourselves and our use of the environment, as Ostrom's principles suggest, and show how to, we can manage sustainability. The question that I try to grapple with is, when do humans actually do that? And what are the conditions under which we do evolve these principles, these institutions that control our individual consumption of resources in order to, first of all, share it more evenly, and secondly, preserve it for a longer period for an entire group? And that's where the cultural multi-level selection framework comes in. So this framework asks that question. We really want to understand when people cooperate to preserve environmental resources and when we create and share institutions that help us do so. And it comes down to 2 interlocking factors. The first one is the more complex one. The first one involves the comparison between the rate and strength of evolution, that is cultural evolution, among individuals, and the rate and strength of cultural evolution between the groups that they're in. Imagine cooperating on a team, a sports team. If you don't have more than one team, then people might take turns hitting the ball or take turns with the ball, but it won't become a very organized sport. It won't become very cooperative. There won't be a lot of interesting strategy. But if you have many teams and they're all competing, people will learn to share the ball, and people will learn to develop fancy strategies. The same thing is true for the way we use resources. The question is, are groups competing to preserve their resources more than or less than individuals are competing to consume them? So if individual competition for resources and the individual driving need to be able to, say, put food on the table, if that's their primary requirement with regards to, let's say, the use of fish, whether they're fishing or not, it's going to be very hard to tell them, I'm sorry, you're going to fish less, if they're simply trying to provide for their family. And so it might not matter that the rules change. The nation says, stop fishing. Individuals are simply between a rock and a hard place, and they'll keep trying to feed their families. On the other hand, if you have a situation where what happens is competition between groups and learning between groups allows people to share solutions that protect the resource but still allow enough resources for the individuals in those groups to persist, then it might be possible to find a solution. Now, let me give you an example. I studied the lobster harvest and the lobster industry in Maine. I did this with collaborator and friend of mine, James Acheson, who has now passed away, but he was an economic anthropologist who studied them for over 30 years and published multiple books, including The Lobster Gangs of Maine, which I highly recommend. What we saw when we looked at the long history of this industry is that it went from an open and very competitive environment where fishermen, lobstermen, were trying to protect the lobster traps they put out because anyone could come and pick them up. So as a result, it became fiercely competitive. And a natural emergence was the emergence of groups of fishermen who would take turns patrolling and protecting all of their lobster pots. They're called the lobster traps. They're called lobster pots, protecting all of them together. This then gave them a way to avoid that external competition, and then internally they agreed that they would not put down too many traps. They wouldn't compete with each other. They would cooperate with each other, and they would compete with other groups by protecting their resources and protecting their borders. That system led to a very stable and relatively well-managed and quite durable lobster harvest. because groups were able to protect their own interests while also working together to protect the resource in the long term. So that's a really good example. This balance between how much individuals are competing to use a resource versus how much groups are competing to preserve the resources they depend on, that's the critical aspect, and that's the question that the multi-level selection framework addresses. So that's part one. Part two, though, is the size of the resource, the scale of the resource. The lobster example works, and it works because lobsters crawl on the surface of the bottom of the ocean, right? They don't swim. If they swam around like fish, it wouldn't matter if you patrolled a certain area of the ocean because eventually all of the fish that are there would swim away. A stable population of lobsters can be maintained in a protectable area. And so if you protect that area, then you can solve the problem of managing that lobster population for your own benefit with you and your collaborators. So we need to understand three things in order to predict whether humans can successfully protect and preserve environmental resources. The first is, how strong is competition between individuals to consume those resources? The second is, how strong is competition and evolution, cultural evolution, between groups to preserve those resources for the longer term? The balance between those will determine where cultural evolution is more effective. And hopefully, it is at the level of the group to preserve the resources. But it all won't matter if we can't have groups that are able to be large enough to fully manage the entire resource. So the scale of the resource itself determines the scale of human society and the complexity of human society necessary to be able to manage it. And we look to try to sort of understand how that might play out in the Anthropocene in this paper.
So, Tim, is there a community of bright and committed people working on this evolutionary problem? Tell us about the Sustainability Working Group and the Evolve and Sustain Network.
Yes, we do have folks who are working on this. I just got back from a very exciting and engaging workshop, which I helped to lead with my collaborator, Becca Kuhman, at the University of Dundee. She and I held a workshop, which was the culmination of 2.5 years of work and a lot of meetings by people in different groups. The workshop was trying to understand how we can use the science of cultural evolution to do sustainability research more effectively and to apply it in different cases in the domains of government and grassroots and community and business and nonprofit sectors in education. All of these groups, we had people, volunteers from those domains talk to us about our ideas about how cultural evolution might be a useful tool for understanding how sustainable solutions emerge and spread. And then we collected their feedback, and we are integrating that into an exciting sort of synthesis, which we're still working on, combing over the findings and the results. But this is an exciting first step in trying to create an applied science of human cultural evolution for a sustainable future. You know, I want to highlight this, and I'll tell you about the other working group as well, but I want to highlight that our research and this paper, which, by the way, is available for free on my website, and I highly suggest people take a look at it and download it. But this paper shows us that we don't know, even in theory, if a species like ours, which evolves with the characteristic patterns that we do, we don't know if we can survive on a single planet in the long term, period. It's unknown, even in theory. And this is a really underappreciated point. So we are trying to build a global research agenda to address this question. And we need talented and smart scientists. We need committed and capable practitioners in all different fields. And we are trying to build a movement, and we are trying to build an applied research agenda. We need to do basic research. We need funding to get this done. There is so much to do. And so one of the ways that we do this is we have a small, you know, applied working group in the Cultural Evolution Society, which has just launched a new website. That working group is trying to address these problems with the resources we have, and I help to maintain an email network of people who are committed to trying to make progress on this front. And the email network is called Evolve and Sustain, and you can also find that on my website, or maybe you could put the link up. We're looking for practitioners, and we're looking for scientists, and we're looking for people who can cross those boundaries well and are looking to make positive change for environmental sustainability using these modern cultural evolutionary tools. So please check it out if you can.
From the Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions at the University of Maine, we've been speaking with Associate Professor Timothy W. Waring. He leads a new study titled Characteristic Processes of Human Evolution Caused the Anthropocene and May Obstruct Its Global Solutions. It is an open-access paper. It's free to read. You can find out more at timwaring.info, W-A-R-I-N-G.info, and you can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim Waring, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
It's been my pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.